Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Meet the Author on Blog Talk Radio. Denny Griffin here, and for the next 45 minutes this morning, I will be your host. And I'm waiting for my guest to call in now. In the meantime, I'll introduce who my guest will be. His name is Al Billings. Al Billings retired as a commander from the U.S. Navy. And during the Vietnam War, he was a helicopter pilot. And Al has a master's degree in computer systems from the Naval Postgraduate School and an undergraduate degree in engineering. He has invented, designed, and built ground support hardware and software for combat aircraft that were used in Desert Storm. He completed a successful 22-year naval career in aviation and has qualified in more than 20 different aircraft. He rose from the enlisted ranks to become the commanding officer of the Navy's oldest combat search and rescue squadron. He was a member of the Navy's only helicopter attack squadron, which was the Navy's most decorated squadron of the Vietnam era, and awarded more than 40 medals and citations for his service to his country, including the Silver Star and the Distinguished Flying Cross. Good morning.
Denny.
Are you there, Al?
Yeah, how you doing, Denny?
Good. Welcome to Meet the Author.
Thanks for having me.
Were you able to hear my introduction?
Yes.
Okay. So you're here right on time. Welcome to the program. And we're going to be discussing Al's book, Seawolf 28. And Al, why don't you just kind of take over and tell us what Seawolf 28 is about and why you wrote it.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a dozen reasons why I wrote it, but one of the main ones that started me on the book was I got a call one day from a retired Navy captain. He was writing a book for the Naval Institute Proceedings. It was called Fire from the Sky, and it was about the Navy Seawolves, which was one of the most decorated squadrons in the Navy. We talked to him. He said, yeah, somebody gave him my name because I had done a few things and got my name in the newspaper and was given a few awards, and he wanted to document those. The whole book was documentation of awards in there. So we went through a few things, and I jokingly asked him, I said, do you want the award version, or do you want to hear what really happened? And he said, no, I only want the award version. So that sort of surprised me to a certain extent, because in several cases in mine, the awards weren't exactly the way it went down. In fact, in two incidences, they were going to take my wings away, and I ended up getting medals for them, and certainly they didn't show that in the awards, and there was a lot of background, and a lot of the awards that go through, they're canned and they get approved by Washington, and they're written, and a lot of times a lot different than it actually happens. The other time that they were going to take my wings is I ended up getting promoted, so I was a little bit of a character, and I wrote the book, and it was important to me to tell the truth. Because so many times today, young men and women join the service and go to war and sometimes make the ultimate sacrifice these days, and they don't get the full truth. So my goal was not to promote myself or anything, but it was to state it exactly the way it was. And that was important to me, and I sent it out to several of the people that were with me in some of the incidences and said, is this exactly the way it went down? And they said yes, because I had read a lot of other books. And over the years, some people don't remember it exactly the same way it went down. So it was very important to me that way. And my goal was that they put down the book at the end of the book and say, this guy was something else, or they agreed with me. It didn't matter. The goal for me was just to state the truth. So, but I was very lucky. I got 5-star rating from the Military Writers Society of America. I even was contacted by a psychologist that bought 5 of the books, and she made it mandatory reading for those people that she supervised on the thing. And
wow.
I had a... Go ahead.
I was going to say that's quite a thing to have the psychologist make that required reading. That's a real compliment.
Yeah, and even I think the Military Writers Society of America, they titled the review that they did for me, and I believe it said a Navy Maverick with True Grit, and I was a Maverick years before Top Gun ever came out. And I've also, I mean, the broad spectrum of the thing was I was contacted by a retired Navy captain and a gentleman that went to Annapolis, and they both said that it was one of the best books on leadership that they had ever read. And then went right down to, I got an email from a mother of a 17-year-old recruit that enjoyed the book so much that while he was in recruit training, that he talked to him, there was five or six other recruits there that requested from their parents as a graduation present that they get Seawolf 2-8. So I think it hit his mark, and that's what I was trying to do, is get the truth out there and tell him. So.
Yeah, like you were saying, sometimes the official version there, or the awards version, isn't always exactly what truly happened. And it's nice to get the actual story of what went down and how it went down. What I'd like to do is anybody who would like to ask Al a question or make a comment, and perhaps someone out there is listening who may know Al or even served with him, you can reach him at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. And also, if you're on my Blog Talk Radio site, you can go into the chat room, Dennis N. Griffin, and text a question, and I'll relay it to Al so he can answer it. And in a few minutes, I'm going to ask Al to give out his contact information and email or website information he would like so that you can learn more about him, his books, or possibly contact him with a question or comment. So if you have a paper and pencil handy in a few minutes, I'll have Al ask him to give out the information. We've got a caller already. Are you ready for a call right now, or did you want to talk a little bit more first?
Oh, sure. I can. It's your show, whatever you want to do.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and go right to the phone call.
Okay.
Good morning. Area code 843. You're on the air with Al Billings.
Hi, Al. It's the Seawolf 16. How are you?
How you doing, Seawolf?
Good. I read your book, and I think it's wonderful. I had a lot of flashbacks going through it. I want to know. I read your certificates and your awards on your Silver Star.
Seawolf 16. How are you?
Hi.
How you doing, Seawolf?
Good.
Okay. I read your book, and I think
got a little bit of feedback. I think 16.
Going through it. I want to know.
It sounds like you're getting a delayed feedback.
I'm getting feedback now. Hang on.
Star.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Oh, okay. I'm getting feedback here, but I'll just ignore it. Maybe I shouldn't be on a speaker box. Hang on.
Okay.
Anyway, are you there?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, I'm sorry. Listen, I read the award on the Silver Star, and I wanted to hear the real story.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Uh-oh. Okay.
I'm getting feedback here, but I'll just ignore it. Maybe I shouldn't be on a speaker box. All right. Well, the way it went down, the real story is, like I said, I was a bit of a maverick, and I was headstrong. And I was probably headstrong for most of my whole career. But what happened is I was ending my tour, my second tour in Vietnam. It was with HAL 3. And the ops officer asked me where I wanted to get the seat, because I was one of the junior officers, but I was one of the more senior pilots from experience, and I had my fire team qualification and stuff. And so I said, I've done everything I wanted to do. Why don't you give me the nugget seat? And to real quick, the nugget seat is there's four seats in a fire team for the pilots, and the number one position is the fire team lead, who was relatively new, and he was the new ONC for the detachment. The number two seat is the pilot in the wingship. The number three seat is the co-pilot who usually handles the radios and navigates for the fire team. And then the fourth seat is a nugget seat. It just so happened the pilot that I was flying with, although he was older and a little bit senior to me, I had trained him while we were over in country because he came right out of the training command. And since I was former enlisted, he was a little bit more senior than I was. So we took off, and what happened is Task Force 116, just after we took off, had been in an ambush, and they blew off the top of a PBR. And the we were heading out to that location to try to help them out. And when we got there, the shooting had stopped, but we flew overhead about 1,500 feet, and the young sailor that was still alive there, or still handling the radios, able to handle the radios, he was screaming and yelling into the radio that these guys are dying right in front of me. And that gets your heart going when you're sitting there and it's getting pumped into both ears that somebody's down there dying, you need to do something about it. But there was nobody around. The Army said that they couldn't come out because there was no LZ for them to make the medevac. So I decided, and the book builds up to this because there were many situations where I got frustrated where people died and we couldn't get to them, and I felt helpless in that situation, and maybe that had a lot to do with it. But I basically took the aircraft away from the aircraft commander and said I had it, and since I had trained him, he let go of the controls, and I took it, and I told the fire team lead that I was going down to pick the men up off the PBR. Now, this was a little bit unheard of because the PBR is only 31 feet long, and the helicopter is 42 feet long, and a loaded gunship usually has about 80 knots of rotor wash, and the boat was floating in the stream there, and they had everybody in the boat was injured, and the captain of the boat was killed. And so I took and told the fire team lead, and he ordered me not to go down because it was too hot of an area. And I don't remember what I said, but I had this big John Wayne complex at the time. I'm sure I said something interesting, and peeled off, went down, laid a strike on one side of the canal with 14 rockets, had the pilot pickle them off, and then did a wing over and came down the other side canal where the boat was floating and pickled off the other 7 rockets and then came on around. I told the fire team lead to keep everybody's head down and circle up there and keep firing into the banks, and then had instructed the one surviving patrol boat to make high-speed gun runs while I was on there because it was a pretty precarious position as we went in. So we went in, but there was no place to land, and the boat was very small. Fortunately, the antennas and the top of the boat had been blown off, so I balanced one of the skids on the side of the boat, sort of chasing it around with a loaded gunship. We had emptied out some stuff, but not enough, and told one of the door gunners to get down on the boat and get the wounded out of there, the guys that were really hurt bad. And luckily he was built like a tackle, so he was able to pull him aboard while the crew chief was shooting up the shoreline on the other side, and the patrol boat was racing by doing high-speed gun runs, and the fire team lead was shooting up the banks on the other side. So hopefully we kept their heads down while I was sitting in the hover there. So when we got him aboard, we were a little bit too heavy, and we pulled off of there. I was almost out of power, and the rotor RPM was coming off. We flew at 6,600 RPM, and we were just slightly above 6,000 RPM, 6,100 RPM. And we settled into the water. I was hoping the hover cushion would help from the water, but it didn't. We were too heavy, so we settled right into the water. But I decided, well, we're not going to stay here, so we headed downstream, and that was... Things were in my favor because the stream was moving pretty fast, and we had the prevailing winds were on our nose. So I tried to get out of the water once, and we lost too much RPM. We settled back in the water, tried to get out again. We lost a little bit of RPM, settled back in the water. Finally, I was able to get enough forward speed to get out of there, enough off of the water to where I drained the water out of the chin bubbles, And then, like all helicopter pilots do, you learn how to milk the RPM and get it off the ground in hot weather and stuff like that. And I was able to get airborne. And we were able to get them to the hospital, and both of the men survived. In fact, I have a chance of meeting them up in Norfolk in July for the first time. So we got to the hospital, got them off, and came back. The ONC was a little hot under the collar, and he read me the Riot Act at that time and basically said that he was going to have my wings taken away for going against a direct order. So it went on for a couple of days, and finally I was called down to Vung Tau to talk to the CO, and the ONC would not tell me why. So the ride down there was not too pleasant. I had visions of my wings being ripped off my chest by the captain, and that was my end of my naval career. But when I reached him, the captain called me in, and I was standing at attention in front of his desk, and he picked up the Navy Times and threw it across the table, and he said, "Is this you?" And I looked at it, and I said, "Yes, sir, I believe so." And he says, "Well, I won't tell the word," but he says a little bit of profanity there, said, "I'm tired of this. You tell your ONC that I don't ever hear about my pilots for the first time reading it in Navy Times," and something that they did. So that broke the ice, and things calmed down a little bit, and I finally started breathing again. And we had a good talk, and I flew back to the detachment out there, and the ONC met me at the detachment, and he says, "I just got a call from the CO, and he says he wants me to put you in for an award or a medal." And I was sort of a hard case at the time, and I said, "As far as I know, I'm not supposed to know anything about the awards. But if you're asking me," I said, "I've never had a Navy Commendation Medal." So for a long time, the joke was is they put me in for a Navy Commendation Medal, and it came out a Silver Star. So that was just one of them. That was just one of them. The other one, the same thing when I got the DFC, I went out single ship. The ONC, a different ONC, told me not to fly because we didn't go single ship. And the SEALs were going in. The SEALs were my drinking buddies. We raised hell quite a bit of the time when we were in Na Bay. And they were going into a bad news area. And they couldn't stop because the weather, the moon was right, the tides were right, and they had to go in. So I told the ONC that I was going. He says, "No, you're not. It's against squadron policy. You're not doing it." And I said, "Yes, sir," and hung up the phone. And then turned around to my crew, and I said, "I need 4 volunteers." And the whole crew, all 8 of them, volunteered to go. But we took off that night, and the SEALs got in trouble. 3 of them were wounded, and they were pinned down. And make a long story short, we shot up the place. They gave us a 27 KIA when they swept the area the next day. And, but we were able to get the SEALs out. We got some Army slicks to come in, and I flew cover for them. We had to reload and rearm twice to go back in, but they all got out, and they all got out safe, and all three of the wounded made it. So made it worthwhile, but when I came back, a different ONC, he was either going to go for my wings or give me a letter of reprimand. But in either case, it just so happened that I believe it's the commanding officer of the SEALs, or one of them, fairly senior, called the CO of the squadron and thanked him for me giving them the support that they needed, and that ended up being the medal also instead of a letter of reprimand. But the whole book is full of those.
Yeah. Well, I have another question, but I want to thank Denny while he's there for highlighting the river rats and the sea wolves and the SEALs and other veterans from Vietnam. And I really appreciate him doing that, particularly next week when he talks to my daughter. But anyway, the other question I have, Alice, I managed 3 tours. I was wondering how you were so lucky and had 4 tours.
Yeah, well, I ended up having 4 tours. I did the first tour, an HC-1. I was signed up and going in training for a combat search and rescue, and then at the last minute, one of the guys on the detachment got sick, and I got shuffled over to one of the carriers. But there was an incident in there where we were supposed to go into North Vietnam, basically unarmed, and the thing going. So, it was interesting, And then I came back, and the XO met me at the plane. When we came back after our cruise, and he says, congratulations. He says, you have orders to Vietnam. So I hadn't even gotten out of the plane before I had orders back to Vietnam again. And HAL 3 was an all-volunteer group. And then there was a break in there for a couple of years. I went back, and I was the ONC of two detachments for tactical air control, close air support. And we did the first tour back over there. We supported five amphibious assaults with the Marines. And then the last tour in there, we got to go back in, and we were part of the aerial minesweeping group in Haiphong Harbor. We were the second ship in the Haiphong Harbor. So I pretty much got to see the war from beginning to end to a certain extent.
Okay. Well, I'll let you go. Let's have some other people call in, and I'll see you in Nashville. And I'll be talking to Denny next week. Good luck with this book and the new one you're working on.
Great.
Good
Thank
talking
you.
There. All right. Thanks bye-bye. Thanks
for calling. Appreciate you calling in. Bye-bye. Well, very interesting stories you just related there. I was going to ask you about them, but they've already been addressed. So you, I see on your website you mentioned that you were referred to as a maverick, and I can understand why, and I'm sure there are a lot of SEALs and sailors who thank God that that was true.
Yeah, I mean, it was across the board in all the areas where, you know, I was called a maverick. It was just the way I sort of, I guess, did my Navy career. The Navy, when I got up for about 9 months and then went back in, when I found out that I was not a civilian and I was not good at being a civilian. So I went back in, and the Navy told me the best I could ever hope for is just to finish that tour and get out, that I would never make 04 or lieutenant commander. And for some reason, they kept promoting me and kept sending me on, and I ended up being a commanding officer of HC-1, where I started out as an ensign, which was the oldest combat search and rescue squadron in the Navy. So I had a pretty successful career. I'm very pleased with it. I have no regrets, as it shows in the book. I did it. When I retired, I had a 65-year-old, actually, I think she was 64-year-old secretary, and for my retirement, she gave me a copy of Frank Sinatra's song, I Did It My Way. And I thought that was pretty appropriate.
Very appropriate. Al, before I forget about this, I promised we'd give out, you would give out your contact information. Would you care to give out any website or email or any information you'd like?
Sure. I have my own website. It's combatsar.com. That's S-A-R, and it's all one word. And you're more than welcome to visit the site, and I have my email address on it. My email address is bcwolf28@aol.com. So.
And if someone has a question or comment, they're welcome to email you with their message.
Oh, absolutely. I've been very fortunate getting the emails and people responding back. I've got about 30 comments and reviews from people on the website. I would have had more, but a little over a year ago, my hard drive crashed, and I lost a dozen of the reviews, comments, stuff like that. But there's about 30 or so comments of various different kinds on there. And like I said, I've been very pleased with it.
Let's return a little bit to writing. Now, when did you actually, your first tour in Vietnam was what year, do you recall?
67.
And when was your final visit?
73, when they brought the prisoner of war back. Actually, we did a lot of training in Subic Bay while they were negotiating the getting the prisoners of war out, because one of the things, agreements, was that the U.S. Navy would sweep Haiphong Harbor for all the mines if they gave all the prisoners of war back. So that was interesting in itself. And that's in the book. There were three commodores in charge, and their egos got in the way. And the DTF-76 had to come down from Okinawa and take charge for a while, because they were arguing with each other who was going to be in charge of the minesweeping group.
nothing like a good ego to get involved with something. okay, so you decided to write this book, and you wanted to get the truth out there. And, you know, from a reader perspective or another author perspective, you might think that in the case of where you're doing something based on your own experiences, that there wouldn't have to be research or very little research involved. But because you wanted to corroborate your memories and your recollections of how certain things come down, you did have to, in fact, do some research and contact other people, other witnesses or participants.
That's right. I mean, you know, you think on over the years and stuff like that, and I didn't want to, it to be a book from an old aging naval aviator that embellished the what actually happened. So these guys kept me straight, said pretty good. In fact, in a few places they said I was playing it down too much. So
you had plenty of input then, huh? Plenty of, you know, cooperation from the people you needed.
Yeah, I had a lot of support over the years. I've kept in touch, and they've reached me as four of my door gunners and a few of the pilots and stuff like that, and a couple of master chiefs and senior chiefs come through the thing. So the book spans a 22-year career. It's not just Vietnam, and it has a lot to do with military politics. It's not just war and combat. It's how people respond and react to situations during conflict, and also as you become a senior officer, there has a tendency to be more and more politics and a thing. So it was pretty interesting. It was a lot of fun to write, kind of thing. But to add one thing, one of the other reasons that I wrote the book is you get to the point, you know, when you came back, Hollywood was so devastating to the Vietnam vets, you know, with movies like Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket, and Platoon, you know. And even today, now they're starting to go after the troops over in Iraq, you know, with Jarhead and Stop Loss. The impact of the media in Hollywood and the returning vets were devastating to many of them, you know. And the kids that are coming out today, which I think is important, because I went to a symposium in Texas Tech University where one of the Vietnam centers are. In fact, that's where Ralph and I met. And I almost walked out in the first 15 minutes because the symposium started with a bunch of war correspondents sitting up at the table. And they had the audacity to sit there and say, we know some of you are Vietnam vets, but we're going to tell you exactly what went down. And they were basically rewriting history. And there's quite a few vets in the place that got upset. In fact, I was about ready to walk out the door. Fortunately, I stayed, because by the time the vets got done with these war correspondents, the second day they were licking their wounds and not saying a word. But they literally wanted to rewrite history. And these at the symposium, all of these were recorded, and they were going to be used for students. They actually have some Vietnam War classes at some of the universities, and they were going to be used for that. So it was great to see the vets stand up and tell it the way it was, because if they hadn't, then these war correspondents would have gotten away with what they wanted to get away with. And the students watching the videos as they were studying the Vietnam War would have basically only had the war correspondent side, which was not true. So the interesting thing about it is they had about 30 Vietnamese there that were exiled, and some of them were fairly senior and politicians and senior military officers, and they got up to speak. And one of them said the same thing, said that they lost their country and they had to leave because of the news media and war correspondents. But the one thing that really surprised me is these senior officers and these senior politicians said that we actually won the war in Tet Offensive in 68, that they said that we had damaged the North Vietnamese so bad that it took them almost another 5 years to recover. But because it was a political war and there was no political will to win, we stopped the bombing and played politics for the next 3 or 4 years and allowed them to rebuild again and recover to continue the war. So it talks about Johnson and McNamara and their role and you know, what the pilots had to do flying into North Vietnam and bombing rivers and things that were unnecessary and risking their lives for it. But it was important, and I think the symposium was well worthwhile after we left there, because it was a 3-day symposium, and like I said, by the time the end, everything was placed out on the table with those people that knew exactly what went down.
You know, two points I want to make. Well, one is just a clarification. When you were answering the caller's question, you mentioned that you were rescuing people from a PBR. For those not with a military background, that would be Patrol Boat River. Is that
right?
Good guess. Okay.
They were the fiberglass patrol boat that Apocalypse Now made infamous. On the thing, and they were some gutsy guys. I just came back from a all Vietnam vets down in Florida, and was lucky enough to share a booth with the game wardens and the people from the PBR, stuff like that. And they were a gutsy group of guys. I think everybody in the booth there's 3, 4, 5, had Purple Hearts.
Oh, boy. and the other thing, if I may, I don't want to get too far into politics here, but I can't help but ask this. You mentioned the news media, the reporters and correspondents and so forth, and, you know, rewriting history and so on. Well, with the presidential campaign going, of course, Iraq is Afghanistan or a couple of hot items in that. And I'm assuming, because all of us are human beings and that the same emotions can be in effect today as there were during Vietnam, as a person who was in combat at the time, when you saw, assuming you did or heard about, for example, Jane Fonda sitting on the anti-aircraft gun in Hanoi and so forth, and the way some of these things were being reported, what effect generally do you think it had on the troops at that time?
I think it's the same as today. The troops out there were just totally professional. The first tour out there, you know, some of the jet pilots, because I got to know a bunch of them down in the war stuff, they were a little bit frustrated flying in North Vietnam, not being able to bomb the proper targets and stuff like that. And they would just take it and try and in stride. And, you know, I guess the bottom line would be consider the source.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that as much, if I could just regress a little bit, wasn't that as much as what the news media and their own government did to the troops, the Vietnam returnees from the war, the way they were treated by the government, the way they were, you know, you've heard the old cliches, they were spit on and called baby killers and everything else, and they were treated pretty poorly. I think it's been displayed quite a bit in the older films from Vietnam, how the VA treated them and stuff. And I think that had a lot to do with how a lot of the veterans adjusted or tried to adjust with civilian life. I mean, getting called all those names and being treated like second-class citizens from their own government that they served and supported over there. And I think the news media and Hollywood and the government can take a lot of credit for some of those guys that ended up being street people and not being able to adjust back to society and all the depression some of them went through, because to go over there for God, country, and mom's apple pie, see your best friend or friends get killed and come back and get treated like that, it's really difficult to try to adjust. Some of them have never adjusted back again.
This is a very hot-button subject for me, and I have a lot to say about it. I'm very opinionated on it. I don't want to tie up the rest of this time talking about it, but you and I have corresponded previously, and I would like to maybe in the fall have you as a guest on a special program and discuss some of the things we were just talking about with the effect of the media and what they can do and influence you know, rewrite history and that type of thing. And I think you said you'd be willing to come on with me. So I'm looking forward to that opportunity to get into that aspect of this thing in a little more detail.
Yeah, I'd love to. In fact, a couple of people have gone to my website and seen the author's views and opinions. And, of course, everybody's got an opinion. But they thought enough of the opinions that they sent them out, shotgunned them out in emails, and several times I've gotten very, very positive feedback on where the country's going, where it's headed, the role of the veterans, and how we can impact these elections and make a stronger America. So I've been very pleased with that, and a lot of positive feedback from those, the authors you used that are on my website.
Well, that's excellent. I read them myself, and I encourage anybody, if you have an interest in this topic, to go to Al's website and take a look at those. I think you'll find some very interesting thoughts there. Returning to writing, how long did the manuscript for Seawolf 28 take from the time you started until you were ready to send it off to a publisher or printer?
Well, it took about a year and a half, and I'll tell you, you have to understand my personality. Although a lot of senior officers thought I was arrogant, I really didn't have that much of an ego, and this is not an excuse. I just knew what was right and what was wrong, and I didn't hesitate to do it. And a lot of times that got translated by senior officers into being arrogant. But I ended up the first time around trying to write it down. I wrote it in third person. And then when I sent it out, not only my wife but a couple of people, and they said, well, this is about you, isn't it? But I wrote it in third person because I was afraid that I would downplay it too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I sent them out and they said, well, this is about you, why don't you write it about you? So I went back and rewrote and put it in first person and put it together, and then had them take a look at it again in certain sections and stuff. But it took about a year and a half. But that wasn't the biggest problem, because it was all there. I had lived it. And I will add this one thing, because the empathy that I have for some of the vets coming back and dealing with the VA, there was a problem, and it was probably from the crash. I crashed one of the planes. I had 9 engine failures, and one of them was south of Saigon, went in the water, and I thought I had twisted my back at the time. I don't know, but since we were out on the detachment, there really wasn't that many facilities there. I'm not even sure they had an X-ray machine, but I just shrugged it off. You're invincible at that time, but over the years, it created a problem, and just as I got out, I was taken to Balboa Hospital in an ambulance, and I couldn't move, and Balboa Hospital refused to treat me. So they drugged me up and sent me over to the VA down close to La Jolla. And I laid there on a gurney for 4 hours. At that time, I was not married. I had my fiance with me, and she was panicked trying to get some help. And I laid there for almost 4 hours. And she was going to everybody trying to get somebody's attention, and everybody was just ignoring the whole thing. Finally, they said, you'll have to make an appointment and come back. Yeah, by that time I was so drugged up, they got me in the car. I was able to cut down on some of the pain, got me in the car and got home. And by the next morning I had lost all feeling from the waist down and had complete atrophy of the left side. So it took me 3.5 years to recover. And that's in the book, but... And I don't want to ruin the book for the people that are there, but I think it's important for people to know, and that's why I think, you know, every young officer and young man that's going to spend a career in the Navy should read the book, because it's got a lot of this type of stuff in it. The Balboa spent the next 3 months trying to cover it up as much as they could, and it left a pretty bad taste in my mouth. So.
I can understand why. That's scary stuff to hear that kind of thing can happen. I mean, you know, you'd like to think it wouldn't, but obviously nothing's perfect, I guess.
I guess the bottom line is whether it's the civilian life or the military or anything else, you're dealing with people. And people will do different things for different reasons. Just it's unfortunate in the military when people respond that way, you can risk somebody's life doing it, so, especially in combat.
Oh, sure. It's a whole different world. So when you had the manuscript, so it was about a year and a half, then what did you, as you were writing the manuscript, did you know what you were going to do in the way of publishing, or did you tackle that issue after the manuscript was completed, or how did you go ahead with your overall project?
I I was a complete novice, and I tackled it after I had the manuscript together, and it was a nightmare.
Amen.
In fact, I was going to ask you a question on that before we go into it. I had a big question for you, but why isn't there some type of a website, or is there a website that I'm missing that can rate some of these book publishers and stuff? I mean, every time I sent the manuscript in with corrections, it came back with more errors than I sent it in with. And I, after a while, I almost gave up on sending it back in because I didn't know what to do. And I paid to have it professionally edited through the publisher, and it came back with all kinds of errors in it. So I was extremely disappointed. And I'm 2/3 of the way through my second book, and I'm doing much more research on it now to try to find a better publisher out there to do something.
Your publisher, then, you weren't. Let me tell you, now, I'm not saying this happened to you, but what happened to me, I did the same thing you did. I didn't address anything other than the manuscript until the manuscript was completed. And it was a mistake I made. I wish, you know, hindsight, that I had done a little checking before I got that far along. However, what I found was I almost got scammed a couple of times because I learned that the publishers who refer you to an editor, there's generally some collusion there, that you pay a pretty good buck, the editor kicks back some money to the publisher, and it's a nice, cozy relationship. And at times, some of these people are even prosecuted criminally for doing that. So what I did is I joined a writer's group, and I started talking to people who had been down the road who were more experienced than me, and boy, what an eye-opening process that was. And I was one site that I would go to all the time now to check things out is Predators and Editors. And they have listings of all your publishers and your agents. And if they've been sued, if they got a bad reputation, that type of thing, you can usually find it on there. And I also go to the website of the particular publisher or agent. And if I see anything that they want money up front, a reading fee, this and that, I've been told by my fellow authors, if you see somebody wants money up front, run like hell, because it's probably a scam somewhere lurking about. So, Predators and Editors is a great thing. Writer's Digest and stuff, that where you can get the names and addresses of legitimate agents and legitimate publishers. It's a little work, but it can save you an awful lot of time, aggravation, and money in the long run.
Yeah. I've got a question for you. You're probably much more aware of this than I am, but this thing was sort of sticking in my craw. Why isn't there a conservative element in Hollywood? Hollywood is there to make money, and I'm bringing this up because I went out a few weeks back and I saw Stop Loss, and Stop Loss was a disaster as far as Hollywood concerns, but they keep making these movies with political and social agendas. It's like they can't help themselves, and they lose money, or they basically break even, you know. And people are sick of it, you know. Isn't there? Do you think a good entrepreneur out there would start something up in Hollywood like Fox News, where they can have a fair and balanced? I mean, there's enough stories out there like mine, and a lot of other ones, that they don't have to make up all of this Hollywood stuff just to slam soldier, sailor, or marine going out there. It just really gets frustrating, and it's surprising to me that the Hollywoods can get along with it because they've got investors backing these movies that they can buy off on it, unless they're just trying to influence as many people as they can, and they don't care, and they're willing to go through and take the loss of money if they want to. But when they get these military movies like Stop Loss and the rest of them, and even Jarhead, there's 26 million vets out there that knows it's garbage, and they've got families, friends, and kids and everything else. So once the word gets out that these movies are out there and that they're slamming the military again by the Hollywood elites, I guess you'd call them, I never will understand or figure out why they're trying to do it, but it just has just always surprised me that there isn't a conservative element out there, because Fox News is doing extremely well, and I'm doing most of the drive-by medias, and every time they do have a movie out there that is well done and is patriotic. It does extremely well because the people are just clamoring for it. They're waiting for one to come out, and they never get a chance to see it because of all of these political and social agendas.
I think you've hit the nail right on the head. That's the only thing I can account for, is that the backers, like you say, have their sufficient money they have that financial reward is not their motive. They can afford to take the loss and to get their message out there, to rewrite history, to degrade the military and prior military conflicts, and the role of the United States in those conflicts. They're willing to spend that money. Now, why they don't have competition, I'm equally puzzled. I don't know if it's if that is so, that Hollywood scene is so loaded with these I call them anti-Americans faction, that you can't crack into it, that they have a monopoly. But yeah, I would think, because the public, I think overall, is fed up with this crap, that if somebody would come along and do a truthful thing like you did with your book and get the real story out there and portray America as a good guy for a change instead of the villain, I really think financially they'd have a gold mine. And why they're not doing it is a real question.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, the stop loss itself, and I sent out a few emails to people saying that this was another one, but it recounts the heroes coming back from Iraq only to be engaged in drunken brawls, and one goes AWL to protest the stop-loss policy, which was totally misrepresented in the movie. Another abandons his girlfriend for a foxhole, laying drunk, digs a foxhole in his front yard, laying there with his gun. I mean, it's just, it's an insult to every one of us that served to see this type of stuff portrayed out there, you know. And maybe it's, but they're trying to build the elites out there, or the intellectuals are trying to build their own self-esteem on the backs of the young kids, now women out there that serve. And it's just a shame.
It's disgusting. And like you say, with 26 million vets, you would like to think there's enough there, enough numbers, the strength, that there should be some way to turn this around.
Yeah.
The question is mobilizing, getting the attention, and that seems to be what works. Al, we ran out of time actually here about a couple of minutes ago, so we stopped live streaming. However, what we've talked about since that time will be in the archive show, so we haven't lost anything. Anybody who replays this will get the full interview. And I want to thank you so much for being with me today. It's been just very enlightening and a real pleasure talking with you. And we'll work on this other project maybe for the fall. And
super.
And some more of the things that we've been talking about.
That was probably the fastest 45 minutes I've spent in a long time. So.
It's incredible, I'll tell you. Again, thanks a million, Al, and I'll be in touch, and we'll set something up maybe for October.
Thanks, Danny.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, again, Al Billings, I want to thank him for being with me today, his book, Seawolf 28, about a lot of it about the Vietnam War and a lot of other things, too, leadership. I'm certainly, if you have any interest in that, or even if you're not a veteran or not a Vietnam veteran, I would highly recommend you check the book out and check out Al's website, including his author's opinions. And we'll see you next time for Meet the Author. Have a good week.